Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Two plagues of modern society, cancer and locusts. A computing science student working with the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning has developed a breakthrough computer program, and this will greatly improve how oncologists target brain tumors for radiation treatment. And Africa is not the only country to suffer from the devastating losses due to locusts. Alberta's early farmers were also once threatened by huge swarms of a now extinct species. It was called the Rocky Mountain locust. But what ever happened to it? These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Treating tumors in the brain is tricky business. Before radiation can be used on a tumor, the oncologist has to map out the target area. But this is still not as precise a science as it could be. Dr. Albert Murtha is a radiation oncologist with the Cross Cancer Institute. He turned to the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning to help him come up with a better method of predicting where the hidden parts of tumors lie. Well, that's a question the group is still working on. In the meantime, they've made a scientific breakthrough in one of the most important steps along the way.
Well, I'm one of the radiation oncologists at the Cross who treats brain tumors with radiation therapy. Like most tumors, there's several modalities involved in the treatment. In brain tumors, the initial modality is usually surgery, in which the surgeons cut out as much as they can safely cut out. Sometimes that's just a small piece of the tumor, given that the tumors can be hiding in fairly eloquent parts of the brain. In other situations, they can debulk a substantial portion of the tumor. Unfortunately, given the nature of these tumors, they can't resect the entire tumor. So at that point, the patient is then referred over to the Cross Cancer Institute for us to do an evaluation regarding possible additional treatment. And usually that involves radiation therapy, which I give, and can also involve chemotherapy, which one of my colleagues give.
What would be the problems associated with that?
Well, the challenge with radiation therapy is to be able to target the tumor. We have a number of sophisticated means of delivering the radiation, but to know where the tumor is located becomes a challenge. Now, we have sophisticated imaging modalities such as CT scans and MRI scans and more recently PET scans and MRI spectroscopy to show us at the current level of technology where the tumor is. But we know from histopathological analysis of patients' brain tumors that there are hidden cells beyond what we can see on these images. Despite how good the images are, there are still hidden cells there that we can't see on them. So the challenge is one of predicting where these hidden cells are. And historically, what radiation oncologists have done and to this very day do is they assume that the hidden cells are adjacent to the visible tumor and that they, because we don't know where they are, we treat every adjacent area as equally probable of harboring hidden cells. So currently what we would do is we would draw what we call the gross tumor volume, which is the tumor we can see on the MRI images. And then we tell the computer to grow that volume approximately 2 centimeters larger in all three dimensions. And that gives us sort of a spherical volume around the tumor that we can see.
How is it then that you got involved with the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning?
Well, after treating a number of patients with these tumors, it became quite clear that that what we were doing, although it's practical, it when you worked it back to first principles, there were some things that just didn't fit. In other words, if the hidden tumor cells were equally probable to reside in all three dimensions around the tumors, you would expect the tumors to be shaped pretty much like perfect spheres. And when you look at these tumors, you'll see that the tumors don't look like spheres. In fact, they look more like clouds. So they have sort of a shape and direction to them. And hence, the hypothesis was that, no, there is a preferred direction for the tumor growth. So the challenge then is, we thought, well, if we could look at all the previous patients' tumors and look at how they grew and their shapes, you know, could we then recognize, you know, patterns which would tell us where, by applying those patterns, would tell us where the hidden cells are. So fortunately, my colleague, Dr. Greiner and his group won an award through Alberta Ingenuity, and it was publicized, and I heard about him, and I thought, that's the guy I need to need to work with to help me with this project. So a few years ago, we sat down for a 30-minute meeting, which lasted about 2 hours, and we were both quite excited about the project, and since that time, we've been working on various aspects of this project.
Once the project actually got started and you were inputting all this information, what came out of it? Were you surprised?
Well, one of the challenges we found initially was that given the amount of data that we have, the large number of MRI scans of patients with brain tumors, one of the first challenges was to be able to segment all of these tumors. And it's a fairly time-consuming process when you consider there's about 1,000 patients in our database, and each of them may have had 6 different MRI scans at different time points. You start to do the math, you realize that I could lock myself away for the rest of my career and may not finish segmenting all of those images. And so one of the initial challenges was to find to automate this process and use the skill set of my colleagues in computing science to automate the segmentation process. And that's, the challenge that Mark took on and has recently done some amazing work in that area.
Why do you need a computer to do all this for you?
Well, you don't actually need a computer. Humans currently do it. We do it every day when we treat a patient. We sit in a dark room and go through, each 5-millimeter slice of the MRI scan and draw the visible tumor that we can see on that. The problem is that it's a very time-consuming process. So that having it automated has the advantage of speeding it up, which in medicine, time is money, and the faster we can do things, the more efficient we can be and treat more patients in a more efficient manner. For our project, having it automated was essential, because the number of images that we need to segment in order to be able to make accurate predictions is immense, and it's beyond the time that we would be able to achieve that goal. So having an automated segmentation program has made it possible to accumulate enough data to make accurate predictions. It also has eliminated some of the inter-physician variability, because we know that if two physicians draw the same image, there will be slight differences from one to the other. And with the automated approach, there is no variability. It is consistent from the first time it segments it to the next time it segments it. So having Mark develop this tool, I'd say in summary, was a cornerstone to moving the project forward to ultimately make the predictions.
Thank you very much, Albert.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Albert Murtha, a radiation oncologist at the Cross Cancer Institute. Mark Schmidt is a graduate student who has just completed his master's degree in computing science at the University of Alberta. Working with Dr. Russ Greiner at the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning, it was Mark's task to go through all the images of brain tumors and determine if there was any way to predict where tumor cells were hiding in the brain. His research has led to the development of a computer program that takes the guesswork out of mapping the brain for radiation treatment.
Well, I was wondering if it could actually be done. It was definitely very different than anything I'd done before. I'd done a little work in the biology processing, but the medical imaging was a very new field to me.
What exactly did you have to do?
Well, I guess the first challenge was just issues of getting access to the data. There was administrative issues of dealing with intellectual property, and are these computing science people actually allowed to look at these images? So the first summer was actually spent getting access to the data. And from there, it's been a matter of organizing it and setting up a database. And also dealing with issues such as how do we compare a location in two different images, and how do we compare what the brightness is in two images? What exactly is being measured in these images, and can they be compared between images?
So these would be images of people's patients' brains?
Yes, exactly.
So how many did you actually have to deal with? How many are input into this database that you're using to develop this program?
I think the number of images is at about 70,000. So right now the database we have is about 200 patients. The total data that we have is about 800 patients over, I believe it's over 10 years. But right now we're dealing with a smaller subset of 200 patients, and each patient will have multiple time points, and at each visit they will have a set of a few, I guess, around 100 images.
So once you got all of this accumulated, what were you actually looking at in order to come up with the process that you've come up with?
Well, so the process that I've come up with is a process that tries to imitate the way humans label the tumor area. The big issue there is that the actual image properties are not sufficient to let you determine what is a normal area or an abnormal area. So when human experts look at this, they know where the brain is. They know, you know, that this part of the image is part of the brain, this isn't part of the brain. So they're not just looking at the actual signal, but they're looking at sort of spatial information and constraints because they know about anatomy. So the big thing that our method does is it tries to incorporate those type of same constraints.
One of the things that Dr. Murda talked about was that if you're looking for these hidden cells, trying to predict where they are and the pathways that the tumor might grow, how do you know what these pathways are?
Well, we don't. What we want to do is we want to try and aggregate this huge database of images to try and let the data tell us where the pathways are. Because rather than actually make assumptions about where they are, we'd like to see what the data tells us.
So does that mean then that tumor cells on a regular basis wouldn't grow certain ways, but they would grow other ways?
Well, that's the hypothesis, and as was mentioned before, if there wasn't some sort of preferential growth, they would be perfect spheres.
What did you find out doing all of this?
Well, what we're going to find out with respect to that problem is still yet to come. We've just got the tool working that can tell us where the tumors are, and we've now applied this to all of our 70,000 images. So now we're interested in exploring what does the data tell us with respect to that.
Now that you've finished this and you've defended your thesis based on this, what do you say the final product is that Dr. Murda would be able to use?
Well, the final product is still evolving. But the product as it stands right now, it would be a tool that he could use to actually label new images. So right now he spends a considerable amount of time actually labeling areas on the images where radiation therapy would apply. But this tool can automate that process. So the advantage there is that you don't have to pay the computer, and the computer never gets tired of working.
So in the 2 years that you spent going through this and developing it all, what really came out for you? Were there some real surprises about things?
I was surprised that it worked. I worked on this problem for about a year, and about a year ago I was convinced that this problem could not be solved, that it would not be solved within maybe 10 years. But a lot of our recent advances have really surprised me in that we've got something that actually works.
So what accounts for that? How come there was such a breakthrough when you're thinking it was almost impossible?
Well, I think the big thing is that after a little bit of warping, you can there's not that much difference between brains. There's fairly predictable locations of different structures within the brain. And when we were able to figure out how to effectively take advantage of that, our accuracy just shot through the roof compared to where it was before.
So would it be similar to Morphin?
Yes, it would be. So it's a matter of trying to find locations in one brain that will also be present in another brain, and then trying to find a way to compare those locations and find the same locations.
So much the same way that if you were looking at faces and you were morphing one into another, this would be with the brains.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, there has been work on similar things with faces.
How do you deal then with sort of the human aspect of this? Because if a doctor is looking at this and is trying to predict where that tumor is going to go, and each person does it differently, how then do you take that variability and deal with it from a computer point of view?
Well, so one of the advantages of our method is that once the machine learning process has taken place, the system will segment an image in the same way every time. So our process effectively removes the variability. But one way that it can be used is it can actually take the interpretations of an image by several individuals and sort of find an average interpretation.
So in a sense, it takes the subjectivity out of it.
Yes.
Where do you want to take this?
Well, I still don't think we've solved the problem, so I think there's still work to do. I think there's fundamental questions from the machine learning side that we can address. There's also questions from the, I guess, the morphing side that could also be addressed. And, of course, there's technology-based solutions such as more effective MRI techniques that we could integrate, such as the spectroscopy that was mentioned earlier.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Mark Schmidt, newly graduated with a master's degree in computing science from the University of Alberta. Dr. Russ Greiner was Mark Schmidt's supervisor and is a founding director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning. While the research on predicting where tumor cells hide is ongoing, Russ is very excited about the breakthrough computer tool developed by his student.
Well, it's wonderful having a world-class result, and Mark and the team that works on this project has done, I think, the world's best results for segmenting brain tumors, which is quite a coup. Many other people cared about this project, and Mark and the team was able to conquer it. I'm very impressed.
As his supervisor, what were some of the challenges that you saw come out of this?
Well, the first challenge was just dealing with the vast amount of data. As Mark mentioned, it was difficult getting access to it, and there was a long delay in that. I was also impressed by the tremendous amount of pre-processing that had to go on before the interesting part could happen. There was a lot of even more interesting work that had to happen to normalize the brains and register them. Register is the morphing project process you talked about earlier. It was just a lot of perseverance that, again, Mark and the other people involved did to make it work.
So how do you take this now and branch it out into something bigger?
Well, first I want to solve this problem. With Mark leaving, there will be a gap that we'll have to have other people step up to fill. But I do want to get the brain segmentation problem solved, or at least go to the next plateau. It's already world-class, but I think we can do even better. And then the project that initiated this, that is doing the predicting where the occult tumor cells are located, is something I'd like to really get a handle on. Once that's done, then I may be using the same ideas for other types of tumors and other applications, which can use knowledge that a person may have access to about symmetries of an organ or about prior knowledge about constituent parts. Use the technologies that Mark and others have developed in solving these other class of problems.
What were some of the problems that you dealt with?
Well, when we first started the project, this predicting where the occult cells were, I remember when Dr. Murtha came to my, and we had a first chat, he showed me a picture, which was, you know, a white region and a black background. I said, that's where the tumor is. I thought, great, I could do this. And then once we've done the segmentation, then we'll look at the hard problem. I was surprised that that wasn't the only type of tumor that appeared, and many are much more challenging, and that was why it took 2 years of hard work from a team of people to get the segmentation at the level it's reached right now. And now we're ready to start on the next phase in trying to get the actual prediction to work.
Thank you very much, Russ.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this.
That was Dr. Russ Greiner, a professor of computing science at the University of Alberta and a founding director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning. I also spoke with Mark Schmidt and Dr. Albert Murtha. When someone mentions swarms of locusts, you probably think that only happens in Africa. Well, up until a century ago, locusts used to swarm across Canada's prairies. Known as the Rocky Mountain locust, the species is now extinct. One scientist who has been doing some DNA research into the demise of the Rocky Mountain locust is Dr. William Chapko. He's a professor of biology at the University of Regina, and he was in Canmore recently for the 9th International Orthopterist Society Conference.
This particular one was the a pest of enormous devastation in the 19th century, and for some reason it went extinct near the end of the 1800s, and the last specimen was found in Manitoba in 1902.
What does the historical data tell us about the Rocky Mountain locust?
Well, if by historical data, if you mean accounts that were set down in diaries and journals, that information does exist. And in fact, if you look at the writings of people like Palliser and other explorers, as well as those of settlers, they would often describe the vast numbers. They would describe the damage. They would describe the fact that the sun would be blotted out, the smells from the vast numbers. In fact, in certain cases, they'd be present in such large quantities, they'd fall into the water, get swept up to the shore, and start rotting and smelling. So there are those records, most certainly. Something actually I do plan to do, not so much as a biologist, but someone who's interested in the history of that period, is to go to Winnipeg and read some of the accounts in the Hudson's Bay archives, to read more about some of these accounts.
How extensive was their range?
If you're talking by range, you mean the how extensive were some of the swarms? About two-thirds the size of the province of Saskatchewan. That big. They were present in the trillions. In numbers, I believe, numbers larger than those described in the Bible for the plague locusts.
Is there any indication as to why they did go extinct?
Well, there are various theories. One is that they didn't really go extinct, but are lying dormant somewhere in some valley in Idaho and waiting for the right conditions to explode again. Another theory is that they're present in the form of another species. A close relative is the migratory grasshopper, which is still present with us today. And that's something we had researched with our DNA work. Another theory that I think is quite valid, the one that's put forward by Dr. Lockwood, is that with the coming of settlements into the Rocky Mountain areas, there was a great disturbance of their egg-laying beds, and that churning of the soil, the presence of cattle, the flooding of areas led to their destruction. And so that's very interesting. In fact, you could say that's the only example we have in agricultural history of a pest being wiped off the face of the earth without the use of pesticides.
You say that you're doing some DNA work to try and, I guess, reconstruct the history or to try and understand what the Rocky Mountain locust was like. How are you doing this DNA work?
First of all, we have to put our hands on the few museum specimens that are there. It's quite remarkable. Something that was present in the trillions, somebody once estimated there's less than 300 specimens in the world in various museums. Anyway, we've been lucky to get hold of some of this material. We've been able to, not in all cases, extract good DNA and sequence that DNA, and compare those sequences with those of, we think, are their nearest relatives to test one of those hypotheses of why they went extinct.
What have you found out?
Well, we don't think its nearest relative is what people think, which is sort of interesting. So I don't think we could say that the Rocky Mountain locust is present with us in another form. It probably did go extinct. Its nearest relative is another species belonging to the same broad group, but not the migratory grasshopper, but one called, scientific name is Melanoplus bruneri, or Brunner's grasshopper, named after a fellow named Brunner.
What's next for you in terms of doing some more research on this extinct grasshopper or locust?
Well, like a lot of things in science, you want to verify your findings. You may want to make your studies a little more precise. Fortunately, we still have some DNA left from these specimens, and so we'd like to increase our database by targeting other genes. We'd also like to get our hands on other animals, and I understand that there is present in the city of Winnipeg, in their Natural History Museum, some specimens preserved in alcohol that were placed in the time capsule in the original city hall. And I plan to contact those individuals and see if we could get a few legs from them.
When something that has such a huge population suddenly disappears, nature doesn't like a void, so it fills it with something else. What has happened to take its place?
Well, in a way, you could say its void was filled by other species of grasshopper, but also filled with humans. Because where their breeding grounds, where we have huge human populations.
Thank you very much, Bill.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. William Chapko, a professor of biology at the University of Regina. He was in Canmore recently attending the 9th International Conference of the Orthopterist Society. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Calgary Technologies Inc., ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Innovation and Science, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.